Naturally Speaking.
Hello everyone. This is Naturally Speaking podcast. I am Martina and I'm here with Lucy Gilbert, who is not only a recent new member of staff at our Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine, but also a new energetic addition into the Naturally Speaking team. Welcome, Lucy.
Thank you.
Today, Lucy and I are going to chat with Dr. Anna Payo-Payo from the University of Aberdeen. Anna, after finishing her Master in Science on Biodiversity Management and Conservation, she moved to Mallorca to do a PhD on the effects of environmental variability and perturbation on seabirds' population dynamics. But let her tell us everything about herself and amazing past and present research. So, welcome, Anna.
Thank you.
The project that I'm working on is led by Professor Jane Reed, and we are also collaborating within the same project with Francis Downed, Sarah Barth, Justin Travis, Geta Bocelli. So the funding of the project that I'm working on is a NERC project, and the project is basically trying to understand how seasonal migration might help us understand what are the co-evolutionary dynamics of different species within the range of climate change. Shags are a very cool species because they allowed us to evaluate many things about migration. Because most of the times what happens is that when you want to evaluate processes that are related to migration, you have to track the individuals. And if they are going somewhere that is the other side of the world, that makes it very complicated. However, the shags have some particularities that make them very interesting. So the first thing is that they are migrating something like between 300, 200 kilometers, but they can also do shorter migrations. So it's very easy to kind of monitor them along the coast, but also they are not waterproof, which makes them have to come back and roost at night after being foraging in the sea. So they are forced to come back to shore every day. And that allows us to track their movement through the whole year. They live all along the coast, but the ones that we are working with are the ones that are breeding in the Isle of Man. And that's where the main focus of the study is. They had the people from CEH and Jane Reed team have been following them across the last maybe 2 decades, and now they have enough data all over the coast. Like, they go to Pornoki, to Peterhead, to Fife, so there's the Bullets of Bakan, Newburgh, so there's different colonies along the coast that they have been monitoring.
So they spend their breeding season on the Isle of May, and then during winter they reach new areas? How does
some
it
of
work?
Them do that, but some of them don't. And that's the thing that makes them particularly interesting, because we have like a partially migratory system, which means that some of the individuals remain in the Isle of May during the winter, but some others, they migrate. So that way we can evaluate the differences in the life history traits, such as a survival or breeding success that they have.
So your study is a modelling study to assess the fitness costs of migrating or not migrating?
Yes, so that's one of the parts of the project, and that's mostly the work that Paul Lacker has been leading, and he has been estimated what the survival differences and the breeding success differences are between migrants and non-residents. And the part that I'm working on is kind of building in all of those parameters that he has estimated into a theoretical model. And this theoretical model is not as scary as it might sound. What this model allows us to do is to evaluate the effect of partial migration at the metapopulation level and to see when individuals and populations might be able to persist. So we assume that migration is going to have a cost, and when they migrate, that might have an effect in the population, at the metapopulation, and we don't know anything about that. So what we aim to do is to see if everybody's migrating, what is the cost of that, and will the population be able to persist? And it looks like migration needs to be very cheap to allow populations to persist. If there were lots of individuals dying during that migration, then the populations and the metapopulation would not be able to persist.
And what are the applications of this theoretical model?
This is particularly relevant when you look at the management of migratory populations. So usually we think that migratory populations, probably the monarch butterflies are the, like, the most emblematic example, or the Arctic terns that they go all the way to Antarctica and back. But most of the species, they are migratory to some extent. And in the face of climate change, if we have populations or species that they segregate in time and space, meaning, for instance, you have a population and all the females go to one winter inside and all the males go to another winter inside. If the environmental conditions are different in those two sites during the winter and one is particularly crushed by those environmental conditions, then when they come back breeding, it might have different effects if the one that it has been crushed is the female side of the population or the male side of the population. So if the females have been experiencing a lot of mortality, then when they come back, there's a lot of males, but very few females. However, if it is the other way around, you would have lots of females and very few males. But the consequences of each one of those are completely different.
And do you find a difference between migrating shags and non-migrating shags in mortality if there are bad weather events, for example, or with climate change?
Yes, we do. And that's very striking because shags are long-lived species and they are most affected by survival. And what we found is that during normal conditions, both migrants and residents, they do more or less the same. But when the conditions are bad, like a couple of years ago that you had the beast from the east, survival is 20% lower for residents than for migrants. And we believe it's because they don't have shelter against harsh environmental conditions. We don't know exactly which is the predominant wind or the conditions that are exactly causing those mortality events. But we know that when there's extreme conditions like huge storm or several days of extreme conditions, then these wrecks happen. That is that we find lots of carcasses of shags along the coast. It seems that the residents are coping worse with those kind of events.
I've been myself on the Isle of May during winter, and sometimes the weather is quite terrible. And the Isle of May is like a window of land towards the North Sea. So when there is a big storm, you can actually see that the part of the island get a lot of wave action, a lot of wind. And I remember quite vividly that there were shags that usually they fly just on top of the water. They could fly much, much higher to avoid all the waves and the wind. And I guess that this can add the costs. And of course, they would decrease the survival of these shags.
I mean, there's different things that might affect their survival. One is that when the weather is bad, they might not be able to get dry again, and their flight capacity is reduced. Therefore, foraging is harder.
Yes.
But we don't have direct evidences for this. It's just what we think is happening. Then what we see is the final effect, not mechanism.
And because you are not busy enough with your research, you also dedicate part of your free time to science communication and outreach, Anna, right?
Yep.
You have just run a workshop here at the Institute on women and men in STEM research, which got actually a tremendous attendance. So thank you for that. Can you tell us more about the background to your motivation for running these kind of workshops?
My motivation for running Women and Men in STEM workshop, it has been increasing lately. I have always been very sensitive to the topic, but a couple of years ago I became a member of Homeward Bound. Homeward Bound is an international project that was born in Australia and was developed by a researcher and by a businesswoman. And what they were aiming to is to empower women in science and give visibility to women in science and provide us with the tools to achieve leadership positions within academia. This program, but how it works is that during a year we get training on project management, looking for funding, strategy, how to communicate our science, how to make ourselves and the women around us more visible. There's 80 women each year from across the globe that work together through this year of learning. And then at the end of that year, we go on an expedition to Antarctica. During this process and after that, I have been developed some skills and also after seeing what women have been experiencing in science, because sometimes we don't talk about it, but there's a lot of things going on underlying that are never...
For example?
There's so much invisibilization within academia and how women feel that feel and are actually being not listened, for instance, in meetings. All the sexual harassment that there's in academia and is not spoken of. Maybe now with the Me Too movement, has some of it has arisen a little bit. And this project has given me the visibility and the chance to speak up and to bring these issues to the table and help maybe institutions to discuss what the issues are within the institutions. It's very rewarding to see some of the things that arise after those workshops.
Do you think that your career changing somehow after this experience with the Homeward Bound?
Well, Homeward Bound has given me lots of opportunities. I mean, the visibility that I have at the moment has nothing to do with the visibility that I had before. And I have always been very active in organizing events and doing science communication. So I already had like a good network of people that knew who I was and the research that I was doing. But after Homeward Bound, my visibility increased and peaked exponentially.
Is that because you made it increase exponentially, or because of the workshops you're doing, or your behaviour changed, or why do you think your own visibility increased because of the workshops?
I think it's a mix of everything. So after we went to Antarctica, I think that the Antarctica part was key for making my visibility higher, because I got lots of attention from the press in Spain. We were five women scientists that created like team to work together and fundraise together to achieve the goal that we had to fundraise to get into the program. In the last year and a half, maybe we have had around 200 interviews from the media in Spain. Some of them were from media, the national media, but mostly the focus of the attention that we got was in Spain. But we were everywhere. We got so much attention that everybody knew who we were and what we were doing.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's incredible. Mm-hmm. So you were mentioning that maybe in Spain, sometimes the situation of women, academia and career is not well recognized, because it's a Mediterranean country, and without offense, I come from Italy. And so do you think that this is going to change the mind or the general thinking in Spain about women, making them more visible?
I think that in the last 2 years we have made lots of improvement regarding making women work and figures visible to the general public and daily life. And especially, for instance, now, the 8th of March, there's the women's strike. And last year it had a huge support. And I think that this year is going to be even bigger. So I think that things are changing. I'm not sure if they're changing fast enough.
So what were the most interesting aspects of your Homeward Bound experience in terms of learning about gender inequality and other people's stories, the people that were also on the Homeward Bound trip?
The most interesting part about being on the program and learning about other women's experience, I guess, was the kind of emerging feeling that happened after everybody shared their experience, that we were not alone, that there were more people out there that they were feeling somehow the same kind of things, experiencing the same kind of things across the globe. It was not, some places were better than others, but the pattern was consistent across nationalities. And to see that there were people that were developing a momentum for action and that was actually happening.
What other highlights were there from the Homeward Bound trip? Or tell us about this boat trip a bit more,
yeah,
to Antarctica. That must have been amazing.
It was actually amazing. I think that from the whole program, not just from the Antarctic Day, because kind of the Antarctic Day was like the cherry on the cake, but we had been working for a whole year before. I think that from that year, what I most appreciate is kind of pushing myself forward and seeing what I was capable of in terms of making myself vulnerable and visible, because at the same time that you are becoming more visible to people, you become more vulnerable and more susceptible to attacks and rejection. And I mean, we had to fundraise quite a lot of money to get into the program, and going and asking and asking and asking and asking and getting all those no, no, we're not interested, no, no, no. It was like it made us kind of toughen up and realize that we were able to do much more than I thought that I was capable of. And that feeling, it was like super rewarding. Also, being able to know all these amazing women. We were on the boat. I mean, I was having dinner with people that had won a Nobel Prize. And it was kind of like, at the beginning, it was kind of like, oh my God.
Intimidating.
Very intimidating. It was like, what do you do? I work with seagulls. What do you think? It was amazing because it was Susan Scott who was involved in the discovery of gravitational waves. And it was just amazing because you had all these people from different backgrounds doing so many amazing things. And it was just like a crystal of cultures and knowledge. And it was amazing. And the fact of being on Antarctica, that was... I think Antarctica has this thing that it does not have people that are native from Antarctica, but everybody that goes there gets besotted by it. And it has this kind of democratization effect with people, that you have a boat full of people, of women from all across the globe, different cultures, different backgrounds, some of them way more privileged than others, like different social classes, status within academia, outside of academia. And then you realize that you face them with Antarctica, and they all become three-year-old people doing like, whoa, look at that. And it's amazing because it creates
a community
that otherwise couldn't be.
So what did you see in Antarctica?
Well, we saw lots of wildlife. We saw killer whales, gentoo penguins, sea star penguins, humpback whales.
Many others.
Albatross, petrels. Mm. I mean, the wildlife there is extraordinary. But for me, the most striking thing was the iceberg, the tabular icebergs. It was like seeing a building floating in front of you, a white building drifting away.
So you were with a Nobel Prize winner who's female, and that's quite rare, isn't it? So tell us a bit more about the inequalities in STEM research, because obviously there's a huge dichotomy between Nobel Prize winners that are female versus men, and right across the board through science.
Yeah, well, she was not actually awarded the Nobel Prize. The project that she had been working on had been awarded the Nobel. So there were three male that were awarded that Nobel Prize. And if you look into the history of Nobel Prizes and kind of like the state structure within the dynamics of the prize, it's about 7% of the prizes through history that had been awarded to women. And that does not mean that women were not involved in the discoveries, because there's a few cases that are very well documented where the person doing the main work was a female scientist, but they were completely overshadowed by their peers. If you look into universities and research institutes, for quite a long time we have had natural science disciplines more or less 50% female, 50% male PhD students, early career researchers. But as you go up into more responsibility positions, what you see is that females disappear, and across Europe it's only 19% of the leadership positions within academia that are women.
19%?
Yeah.
Oh. And haven't there been some fascinating research studies on just that sort of innate sexism that we all have in us about the value of women? Can you describe some of those studies?
Yeah, very recently there was a study that kind of gathered all the information about the projects that had been... all the applications that had been submitted to projects for funding in Canada. And what they found is that when the committees had into account only the science, they were as likely to give research funds to female and male scientists. However, when they accounted for the CV of the person, therefore knowing they were female or male, they were less likely to give funds to females than males. So that reduces the opportunity for females a lot. There's another one that is quite famous, is the famous John and Jennifer article that was submitted to different journals and review processes. And what they found that it was that Jennifer, so the article signed by Jennifer as first author.
So this is people submitting a paper to a journal.
It's a study that what they do, they mimic the submission process and they ask people to review it as if it was for submission. And the only thing that changed is the name, first name in the authorship. So John had a significantly higher probability of getting the paper published than Jennifer. And that was the only difference.
So exactly the same paper, only changed the name.
But the reviewers were all males, or there was a mixture between male and female? So you saying that also female reviewers can actually be biased?
Yeah.
Towards men.
Yeah, in fact, there's another study that looks at what are the chances of a researcher getting employed or not. And they did pretty much the same. It was the same CV. The thing that changed was the gender of the applicant. And what they found is that no matter the gender of the person that was evaluating the application, it was the male applicant that got more chances of getting hired.
Incredible.
It is.
We have some challenges ahead.
We do. So you ran a workshop here in the Institute.
It was yesterday.
Yesterday, and which was excellent, so thank you for that.
Thank you.
And you asked us to write down steps that we can take to help close the gender gap in science. And you asked us to do this from the individual level, like what we personally can do, from the lab group or the Institute level, and then also at the level of science in general. So what key actions come up repeatedly when you're running these workshops in Spain and here? When you ask people to do this in your workshops, what are the repeated sort of answers to what on earth can we do about this?
The repeated answers that we get in the workshop are usually at the individual level. I think that people get like a wake-up call that at least lasts for the hour or hour and a half that the workshop lasts. And it's kind of like the feeling that they have to start speaking up. Both the female scientists say, well, I have to start saying that these things have happened to me. And the male scientists usually say that they have to speak up themselves to call these kind of things. I don't know how long does that last after the workshop, because that's kind of the challenge, to keep that in mind and beat the social pressure and the peer pressure that is around. Very often people look for responsibility into higher levels of responsibility, so kind of PIs should lead by example. PIs should get involved in this kind of measure. Many times there's kind of the hope of creating like a committee that drives forward some of the measures. What happens very often is that we do these workshops and they take 1 hour, 1 hour and a half to start with. But the ideal process to work through this is a more longer term. So you establish the base, the cellars of what you want to do within your institution in 1 hour and a half. And that's not enough. So you should work 1 day, 1 week in working groups to see that everybody agrees that this is a problem, that we have to tackle it, and how are we going to do it with more concrete actions. If we don't get to define those concrete actions, it's very hard that even though everyone has the intention of changing things, that things actually happen. Because everything becomes very vague and we need short, concise actions to tackle.
We have the scheme called the Athena Swan here in the UK that try to put objective by a committee or university committee and trying to tackle some of the problems about gender equality. And our institute has actually got the silver one.
Yeah, so, silver award for Athena Swan. There's a bronze, silver and a gold. Yeah.
So, yeah, we are trying to do. Either you can come back to give more workshops as well.
So, apart from the Homeward Bound programme that you've been part of, what other initiatives are there, especially in Scotland?
There's an initiative in Scotland that is called Ingenious Women Scotland that was founded by Janet Wilkinson and Sarah Sinton. and it has run for 4 times in University of Edinburgh, and they are running workshops all across Scotland, and they pretty much the same that Homebound, and it's kind of empower women to in science and STEM to step up and to try to make themselves visible and maybe transfer to industry and promote their own ideas and train them to be the best they can.
And in the workshop yesterday, you talked about how each individual woman can maybe speak louder or be more confident, and you talked about imposter syndrome. Can you tell us what that is?
So the imposter syndrome is this feeling that everyone has, that you feel that you're not good enough and everybody else is better than you are. And I think that for most researchers, this is especially acute when you go to a conference. And this happens across ages, gender, but it looks like there's some research that says that male scientists, they suffer more from imposter syndrome under very, very, very stressful conditions. However, under normal conditions, it's female scientists that suffer it more. This topic is a little bit tricky because it's kind of setting a baseline that somehow you assume that women are guilty for the situation in science because they don't speak up. And that's not true. The situation that women have in science and in wherever you go is not their fault. It's a consequence of the cultural constructs and history of undermining women through history. However, while we're working on fixing this, one of the things that we discuss in the workshop is that, for instance, women usually only apply to jobs when they fulfill 100% of the requirements of the application call, while men apply when they only fulfill 60% of the requirements.
That's a massive difference.
It is a huge difference. But there has also been some studies that show that if you reward the applications in different ways, you can hugely increase the probability of women applying for those jobs. So there's some work from both sides. It's not only that we have to put the weight on women saying, oh, you have to apply more, you have to put yourself forward. No, the system has to provide the support that women need to shine and raise in science as much as their male peers.
I would add also believe in ourselves a little bit more. That would help anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Easier said than done when you've been undermined since you were born.
Okay, Anna.
So you've come down to Glasgow from Aberdeen to give a seminar on your scientific research and to give us a workshop on the women and men in STEM research. So you've been here for 2 or 3 days now. So how have you found it? How have you found the Institute in Glasgow?
I have loved it. I've loved it. I mean, I have been meeting lots of interesting researchers and people. There's a lot of interesting research going on in Glasgow University and the Institute. I'm overwhelmed. I'm overwhelmed with all the things that I have been able to interact with. It has been great.
It was amazing having you, Anna.
Thank you.
So thank you very much for sharing all your research. And as well also your outreach experience. I discovered so much of you both as scientists and women. But just to end our chat, please, could you share a fun fact about yourself that maybe not so many people know about you?
A fun fact about me? Maybe a fun fact about me is that back in Spain, I used to do stand-up comedy.
Wow.
Stand-up scientific comedy. So I was doing...
So serious comedy.
Yeah, very serious one. Very serious. I was kind of communicating my research to the general public through the stand-up comedy. However, it happens that when you change the language and you move into English, I'm not that funny anymore. And I have to learn how to build the jokes again. And
maybe we should be the judge of that. Can you tell us a joke?
We forgive you.
Okay.
And thank you very much for this amazing chat. Thank you, Lucy, of course, as well.
Yeah, thank you, Anna.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast. If you've got any ideas for future shows or want to get involved, then please contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is naturallyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com. Naturally Speaking is a podcast from the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine at the University of Glasgow. For more information, you can find us on Facebook, You can find us on Twitter at the NS Podcast, and you can download future episodes and find more information at our blog at naturallyspeakingpodcast.wordpress.com.